So we think on those things that are true, on those things that are honest. And we need to realize that the Holy Spirit will lead us into all truth.
The divine beings in rebellion against God were creating this army. And the kind of terminology that starts to come through in the flood narrative depicts this as a massive cosmic war. Cosmic war.
This is your nautical lantern on the dangerous seas of darkness. Let's push off from the placid shore of the status quo and explore what's beyond the horizon. I am your host, BT, and this is Truth and Shadow, your podcast of the supernatural.
The initial chapters of Genesis form the bedrock of Judeo-Christian theology. These profound narratives delve into the very fabric of existence. And in this episode, we'll embark on a journey through these verses. We'll find ourselves navigating a puzzle involving the realms of creation, of humanity, and the divine. These mysteries, concealed within these pages, serve perhaps as keys, unlocking doors to deeper understanding and contemplation. In the opening chapter, we're thrust in the cosmic symphony of creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It shows us the meticulous order in which God shapes the cosmos. From the separation of light and darkness to the formation of land, sea, and sky, it all reveals the divine craftsmanship that underlines the precision and intentionality of the Creator. And as we ponder these intricacies, we find ourselves contemplating the nature of God, omnipotent, deliberate, creative. The very act of creation becomes a lens through which we can glimpse the majesty of a higher power, laying the groundwork for a philosophical and theological understanding of the universe's purpose and its design. When we move into the second chapter of Genesis, the focus shifts from the grand cosmic creation to the minuscule, to the intimately personal. God molds humanity from the dust and mud of the earth, breathes life into Adam. Creates a garden, which becomes a sacred space, the very first harmonious dwelling where humanity walks with God. The portrayal of God shaping humanity with his hands seems to emphasize this intimate connection we're supposed to have between the Creator and us, his creation. The story echoes throughout the theological corridor, suggesting that humanity is not a mere byproduct of cosmic forces, but rather a deliberate, cherished creation in which we all have a unique purpose. The creation of Eve, it deepens that narrative more, introducing the concept of companionship and partnership. In the union of Adam and Eve, we glimpse the profound mystery of human relationships. The divine act of creating humanity in God's image sets the stage for understanding our inherent dignity, value, purpose. However, the idyllic scene in the garden is soon disrupted by the introduction of the serpent and the incident of knowledge of good and evil. The fruit of this tree becomes this focal point that examines our free will and shows us the consequence of disobedience. As Adam and Eve exercise their free will, partaking in that forbidden fruit, this mystery deepens. The consequences of their choice reverberate through the ages, shaping the human experience with the weight of moral responsibility. One could say that this is a pivotal moment in Genesis, laying a groundwork for understanding the human condition, the struggle between good and evil, of concupiscence, and begins, brick by brick, building the foundation that leads to the redemptive journey. The value and importance in these early chapters clearly extend beyond any kind of historical or literal interpretations. The theological reflections that have been inspired by Genesis have been penned throughout the centuries, offering profound insights into the nature of who we are, what we are, who God is, and how all of it connects. The creation narrative challenges us to contemplate the purpose of our existence. It prompts us to reflect on the Imago Dei, the image of God, stamped like a coin upon humanity, reminding us to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and giving to God what is God's. It invites us to recognize the inherent dignity of every individual. You know, the introduction of free will and choice in the Garden of Eden confronts us with the complexity of our moral landscape. It challenges us daily to navigate the tension between obedience and rebellion, virtue and vice. And in conclusion, these first few chapters of Genesis are not merely a historical account, but a doorway into the profound mysteries that shape our understanding of existence and faith. This ethereal symphony of creation, this intimacy of humanity and divinity, and these complexities of free will and choice intertwine to form a narrative as valid today as it was 100, 1,000, 10,000 years ago, transcending time and cultures. And in this episode, as we delve into these verses, we'll embark on a journey that invites contemplation, reflection, and a deepening connection to the overarching narrative of faith. The mysteries within Genesis beckon us to explore the depths of theology, challenging us to grapple with the profound questions that define our human experience. And in this ever-unfolding narrative, the value and importance of Genesis persists, offering a timeless wellspring of wisdom and inspiration for those who seek to understand the divine dance between creator and creation.
Five, four, three, two, one.
In the genesis of our world, the God Most High painted creation with strokes, brilliant light, setting the stage, order and chaos. Within the garden, Adam and Eve found themselves ensnared in the tantalizing allure of forbidden knowledge, as the serpent's whispers echoed through the hallowed groves, a symphony of disobedience unfolded. In the dim glow of divine judgment, Noah, harbinger of salvation, constructed an ark to navigate the waters of redemption and renewal. Then, in a twist of fate, human ambition sought to pierce the celestial veil to bring God down to earth. In response, the divine hand confounded their language, scattering them across the earth. Joining us is the author of Answers to Giant Questions, taking us back to the start of all the blurry things we find in Genesis. He is the dismantler of deception, the veil vanquisher, the rogue reality revealer. TJ Stedman, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, BT. It's great to have this opportunity to talk with you and to share with our guests on the show.
One of the main things that drew me to you was your own podcast of the same name, Answers to Giant Questions. And you've gone over so many of these questions that people have within the Genesis narrative. And I thought it'd be awesome if we can bring you on and start talking about these trigger points within Genesis, pretty much 1 through 11, and all of the foundational starts that really lead to a cause of the eventual coming of the Messiah.
Yeah, that sounds great.
If we start with Genesis 1, obviously we have the creation of the world. You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth being formless and void. What can we tease out of this creation story, even leading into the creation of man?
Yeah, this is possibly the biggest stumbling block for modern Western readers of English Bibles. You know, it's just ingrained in us at this point in human history, and we've been following the narrative sort of laid down by the Platonic authors, you know, ever since the Greeks rose to power, that everything in our world is oriented around material and what stuff is and what it's made of and that kind of thing. And when we come back to Genesis 1, what we find is a world devoid of those concerns. you don't have people asking the question, where did the earth come from? What is the sky made of? These kind of things. Instead, people are concerned about function. Because we're in the ancient world, you've got to be pragmatic. It's a subsistence culture. You live one day, you die the next. Everything has to be functional. If it doesn't work for you or serve a purpose, it's functionally, it's nothing. And that's the whole point that comes through in Genesis 1. When we actually pay attention to the text and we let it say what it says instead of reading our own story back into it, what we find is the materials of the world are already there in the story. And that's confronting for a lot of people, because we want to start with our theology and we want to talk about the eternal God who was there before everything else was created. And we want to look at Genesis 1 and say, well, this is the origin of all the stuff in the world. And I think if we're just being honest with the text and letting it say what it says, that's not the message of Genesis 1. And that's, you know, that's disturbing for a lot of people. It's going to upset their apple cart a bit, because we were all sort of brought through Sunday school education with this idea that God made everything out of nothing. And I agree with that. I just think that Genesis 1 is the wrong place to get that theology from. You can do that in the New Testament.
And then, obviously, we have the creation of man, but the important part with the creation of man is God brings Adam, all the animals of the world, basically to him, and they're trying to find a helpmate. And this is the idea where, or the necessity where Eve comes along, but what's the deal with parading the animals to Adam?
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing. And I think there's not enough people asking that question, right? We just take it at face value. Oh, okay, it's Adam's job to decide, that an elephant is called an elephant and, you know, cats are going to be called cats. But that's not what he's doing. He's looking for something. He's been given the task of trying to figure out who he is. And as he goes through the animal kingdom, he begins to realize his uniqueness. And this is where God is driving him towards. You are special. You are not the same. And that means, you know, a different approach to who we are as humans in the world, and what's our responsibility in the world toward the animals and the rest of the created world.
Yeah, because the big question is, if, you know, God creates these animals, and then isn't man just another animal?
Yeah, that's right. And later on, as we go through the primeval history, we will see that distinction begins to blur. But at this early stage, the task of man is to recognize his equality with his female counterpart, which occurs in a really weird dream vision, right? Like this idea that he goes into a deep sleep and God cuts him in half.
Cuts him open, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's designed to communicate the idea that the woman is his equal and opposite, and they're supposed to work together.
You know, we get this rule, you're not supposed to eat from these trees in the garden, and it's kind of peculiar situation because there's so many mythologies with these trees that are involved in the stories. You know, you have the Viking mythology, the Norse mythology that involves the gods. They have to eat the apples of a specific tree to maintain their immortality. And here in the garden, you've got this tree of knowledge of good and evil, or more like the experiential knowledge of good and evil, and the tree of life. And you have the wily serpent who comes and says, hey, no, you can eat that. You're fine. You won't die.
Yes, that's the great challenge of our lives, isn't it, to recognize those moments when they come up in our everyday situations. But yeah, the trees are interesting because in ancient culture, trees were often used to describe sentient beings, okay, so people or divine beings. Even throughout the Bible, you'll find it used of kings and, you know, royalty, people in power. There's so much meaning that can be teased out of this idea, the imagery of trees. And in this situation, it's my contention that what we're seeing here in Genesis 2 and 3 is the use of trees as representative of divine beings who inhabit this sacred space that God has created and who are sharing that space with the man. So then what happens is we have a kind of temptation to walk away from the allegiance to the Most High God and to try what the other divine beings are offering.
Because man at this point is not truly destined to be a spirit entity. It's flesh. We're designed and made to be distinctly different from the heavenly host.
Yeah, and that's an essential part of creation, right? I mean, when we talk about creation, we shouldn't be thinking about material origins. Again, we're thinking about making things work in an ordered system, and functionality and all that is a primary part of that discussion. So when we get into the distinction between humans and these divine beings that inhabit the unseen world, those distinctions have to be maintained. And again, that's where people are going to get in trouble as we continue through the primeval history.
Absolutely, because it makes a whole lot of sense as we get past the expelling of the garden here in a minute. Then we enter the stage. The stage enters really quick, the serpent entity, the Nephash. And we have Eve interacting, apparently alone with this other spirit being that was clearly in the garden. And it's really a weird story because when we get to the curse, God curses this snake to crawl around on the ground and eat dust all the days of its life. And it's a snake. That's what snakes do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, snakes are a popular image for divine beings because a snake can be observed to shed its skin and appear to be regenerated. And this carries the idea of immortality. Mm-hmm. And long life also is indicative of wisdom. So the idea that a divine being should appear as a serpent-like creature for the purpose of storytelling, you know, I don't think that Eve was actually looking at something that looked like, you know, a snake talking to her. I think that Eve's interaction with this divine being probably appeared quite natural, as we might see in the example of Abraham and the visitors that he received prior to the destruction of Sodom. You've got these divine beings who come and they just interact like normal people do. You know, but the idea of talking about this entity in terms of a serpent gives you those particular traits of these immortal beings. Okay, so we're talking about that immortality, that wisdom, that craftiness, you know, all these kind of aspects that are important to the narrative. So I think that's why he's depicted there as a serpent.
And the idea is that basically a seraph or some kind of angelic host is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting mixture of motifs there, because on the one hand, you've got the seraph, which is common in Egyptian iconography and during the time of the early kings of Israel, because they had ties to Egypt, you often had imagery of seraphim, like Isaiah will use that, for example. Later on, you get to Ezekiel, and the imagery shifts because the cultural paradigm has moved a bit, you know. So rather than the seraphim, you have the cherubim, which are more connected to the Akkadian cherub. Cherubs, I think they're called, something like that, cherubim. And again, it's a similar image. It's just using a different sort of cultural image. But that comes through with this bit of Egyptian flavor here, which is interesting because when you get to Ezekiel, he talks about this entity known as the Assyrian. Actually, Isaiah does the same thing. This divine being known as the Assyrian, who apparently was there in the garden. And I guess you can do the maths and say, well, this is probably the same guy. And later on, we're going to find him associated with Nimrod. So that gets really interesting there.
Though, well, the consequence of consuming the fruit and giving some to Adam, who was with her in the garden, leads to the expulsion of Adam and Eve, and then the ultimate first animal sacrifice performed apparently by God himself.
Yeah, that's a very interesting situation, and so much stock has been made of that. That particular element of the story. You know, we still have stories persisting to this day about divinely created garments and that kind of thing, and all kinds of legends and mythology around those. But I think, you know, when we come back to what we were talking about earlier in Genesis 2, where the man is supposed to be cognizant of the fact that he's different to the animals, that he's got a higher purpose, that he's not called to just do what it takes to survive. Mm-hmm. He has to put others before himself, right? When we think about that and we see what happened in that transgression in the garden, the response of God is, here are some animal skins. Doesn't it feel unnatural to be wearing them?
Right.
Right. This is a reminder you're not supposed to be acting in a selfish way, like you have to fight for everything you get and take it on your own terms. You know, I am your God. You can rely on me. You can trust me. I give you what you need. You don't need to take it on your own terms. And I think that presentation of those garments was there to provide a physical reminder of that.
That's a real interesting thing, because anybody who's had children or been around really young children knows that they develop this acute allergy to wearing clothing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then absolutely. It makes sense, because the whole point of modern clothes today is to make them feel as comfortable as possible. Well, we get kicked out of the garden. There's a couple of children that come along, and right away we see that these two boys, Abel and Cain, are at odds. And it's almost first parts of Genesis are seem to be written by Mark the Apostle, because it's just action, action, action.
Yeah. Yeah, Genesis 4, I think, is one of the most fascinating chapters of this whole storyline, because it takes a lot of digging for us as readers of an English Bible to get at what's really going on here. Because when you just read it in English translation, you miss so much. This story is so deep and so complex and so poignant. You know, there's so much meaning and the lessons that come through in this are so important. Right? When we look at Cain and Abel, we see these brothers who have been brought up in a situation that they know isn't ideal, right? They're outside of the Garden of Eden, and they're very much aware of that. And the offerings that they bring, the terminology behind those offerings is supposed to convey the idea of appeasement, right? So they know things are not right, and they're trying to acknowledge that before God and trying to turn the situation around. And the reason that that's become pressing for them is because the good times that they enjoyed in shepherding and growing crops, those days are over. And that's really hard to pick up in the text, but it's there. The idea is that those days of prosperity in their farming have finished, and now things are getting desperate. And as I say, we're talking about an ancient culture which is subsistence living. If your crop fails in just one season, that's it. Your family dies. You don't have safety nets. You don't have social security. Right. So it's incredibly important that these brothers find a way to get in the good graces of God and to throw themselves at his feet. So they've brought offerings, and one is accepted, the other is not. Again, it takes a lot of teasing out, and the author of Hebrews is really helpful in this and just says, well, Abel's was more acceptable because Abel was faithful, right? So it wasn't about what was sacrificed. It was about the heart. And Cain is now getting desperate because his sacrifice wasn't accepted. His fortunes haven't turned around, and he still has to provide for himself and whatever family he has at this point in the narrative. So what's he going to do? And his solution is to turn to another divine being and offer a sacrifice to him. And the sacrifice deemed acceptable for this purpose is his very own flesh and blood, his brother. So, of course, that action immediately meets with condemnation. But it doesn't come without a fair bit of forewarning, right? Before this all happens, you know, God says to Cain, you know, if you do the right thing, you know, aren't you going to be accepted? And it's an interesting turn of phrase here where it talks about sin crouching at your door. Right, we've taken that to mean, well, you know, if you go through with this, then you're going to go down the path of, you know, doing the wrong thing, and you know, sin will take over you. Some people have even suggested that this animalistic sort of language of, you know, sin crouching, mm-hmm. like some kind of a demon or an animal, you know, suggests perhaps an intelligent entity at work here, where sin becomes some kind of personal being that Cain interacts with. But the interesting thing about it, that though, is the word for sin is actually the identical word used for sin offering. Okay, and you can look that up through Leviticus. Now, what that means is that Cain's brother Abel has actually provided a sin offering and left it there for Cain. Okay. At the entrance to the Garden of Eden, right? The entrance to sacred space, this is where they are. And the idea is that Abel's tried to do the right thing here to support Cain in the hard time he's going through. He's trying to help Cain to repent and to turn back to faithfulness. And Cain has rejected it and turned to basically the human sacrifice of his brother to a foreign god in order to secure what he needs to keep his family going.
Yeah, because we read later on in Leviticus, we get these Levitical sacrificial laws that are given to the people. And it's like grain is acceptable. Grain is an acceptable sacrifice to God. So you sit there and you go, well,
exactly.
Abel does an acceptable sacrifice of, you know, animal flesh. And Cain does this sacrifice of grain. And it's like, well, but when we find out it's a matter of faith, because in Isaiah, God says that sacrifices I've not desired, but a heart, you know, of, you know.
That's
right. Supposed to love God, love neighbor, not just, here, God, I want to give you my best sheep. Have it because I've burnt it to a crisp. I mean, it's almost an unintelligible argument for pro-sacrifice if we're failing to understand the aim of giving from the heart. So Cain kills Abel. He's banished. He's given a sign or seal. Do you have any hypothesis about this particular seal that Cain's given?
Oh yeah, the mark of Cain. Wow, this is such an important one to get right, because I'm sure you're aware there are all kinds of ideas about what the mark of Cain actually was, and a lot of it is speculation about a person's physical appearance. So if they look like this or they look like that, they've got the mark of Cain, right? So in days gone by, it was hypothesized that perhaps people with black skin had the mark of Cain. This was largely driven by colonialists, you know, they're expanding their horizons beyond the known world. And when they get there, they find people. Mm-hmm. Right, usually black people, and they're like, well, where did these people come from? And they've got to find some place in the biblical story where they could fit them, right? Because they don't come from any of the countries they know from the Bible. So, you know, this idea of the mark of Cain might give them a little wiggle room here to squeeze them into the story. It also means that they're bad guys and they deserve to be conquered. And, you know, these are horribly racist things, right? I mean, nobody with a shredded conscience would push that kind of thing today, but you do still see it taught, sadly.
Well, it was taught all the way up in Mormonism for a really long time.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, some of these things go to the bizarre as well. Like, you have the idea that Cain had horns on his head, or that he had a real hairy coat to his body, or that he had a peculiar way of walking, like he had a limp or something like that, because this land of Nod, the land of wandering,
yeah.
Interpretations of that terminology led people to think, well, this is a land where, you know, he's sort of rocking back and forth. He is unsteady on his feet, so that must be the mark, you know, his peculiar walk. But for me, the mark of Cain is actually quite simple there in the text when you think about it. God makes a little statement, a little spiel that he says about Cain. And he talks about Cain's behavior. And so what he does is he establishes a reputation for Cain. He says, not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And that's not the vengeance of God on someone who kills Cain. It's the vengeance of Cain against anyone who slights him, because, you know, he felt insulted after his brother had sort of shown him up at the altar. So this idea of murder in response to an insult is this idea of sevenfold vengeance.
So his retaliation.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and disproportionately so. In fact, the idea of sevenfold gives an almost divine retribution sort of feel to it. So then, of course, we see that exaggerated later with his descendant Lamech.
Yeah, so it's not a matter of eye for an eye. It's more like an eye for two eyes or an eye for two eyes and all your teeth. Exaggeration.
Yeah.
Well, after Cain's expelled, we have another child comes along for Adam and Eve, and that's Seth. And things seem to kind of be honky-dory for a while, up until this point in time when many translations will say the sons of God or the sons of Israel or whatever, or the sons of Seth come and they take wives from the daughters of men. What's going on here?
Yeah.
To lead our world into depravity.
Yeah, now, yeah, we're getting into the fun stuff now. And you can track that, of course, back to Genesis 4, because you have the line of Cain and this technological explosion that seems to happen among Cain's descendants.
Yeah.
And I'll let you in on a little secret. Like, genealogies are not nearly as boring as people have made them out to be, but you just got to know how to read them. Right, when we look at Cain's genealogy, firstly, it's kind of a fake genealogy. It's meant to read like it is one, but it actually isn't. And you've got things there like men giving birth to men, which is not meant to be taken literally. It's like the names mean something, and if a man is the father of that thing, it's like he invented it, right? So we say, you know, Henry Ford is the father of the mass-produced automobile, right? He never once gave birth to a car. But that's the way they talk about this technological explosion, and you've got all these things coming forth from Cain's descendants. And the question there is, firstly, where's all this stuff coming from? Secondly, why are we getting the mention of unusual people in the genealogy? How come we have women mentioned in places where they're not sort of integral to the story, right? So you've got Lamech's wives, right? I mean, in other places, you don't get the wives, you just get the sons. Then you have I think it's the sister of Tubal-Cain. You know, why are these people mentioned?
So Nehemiah?
Naamah, I think, yeah. So why are they there? They're there because we're going to see connections, right? These are names that mean things like beauty and adornment and this kind of thing. When we get to Genesis 6, we find that the story takes a turn around these beautiful women.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is, of course, after we've followed another genealogy through Genesis 5, which connects us from Adam to Noah, ultimately showing that Noah was the better Adam because he actually went through and did what was required of him. So that was really the point of Genesis 5. And, of course, a lot of people wanted to pin their hopes for interpretation of Genesis 6 on Genesis 5 and say, well, you know, we've been following the good guys, this line of Seth, so naturally we're going to keep that going and follow that interpretation through into Genesis 6. But it's problematic because this idea of the sons of God, and I know you've talked about this stuff on the show before. I've actually been enjoying listening to your show. For all the episodes, actually. This idea of the sons of God, suddenly we're dealing with something that doesn't correlate to ordinary people who were, you know, perhaps morally good. right? And I mean, this is technical terminology. We're talking about divine beings. We're talking about high-ranking heavenly entities. And they suddenly succumb to temptation. And they decide they want to get involved with these beautiful women. Mm-hmm. So we start to see the breakdown in the created order and the mixture between the divine and the human. Once again, it takes a different form this time. So instead of the temptation to, just question what God had said and, you know, did God really say, you know, well, just try it and see what you think. Now we're getting an intentional mixture, and the idea now is rather than, if we make the man sin, then God will kill him. Instead, we're going to say, right, God isn't going to kill the man, but we can breed him out of existence. Right? And I mean, the question has to be asked, well, why would you do that? And I believe that the fallen powers here are creating an army.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is why you need people who are big and strong, right? So this is what you fill your military with. You don't fill it with, you know, skinny little nerds who are good at knitting and, you know, reading
books. Drone pilots.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So, you know, you need some heavy artillery. So along come the Nephilim. Of course, when I read that word Nephilim, oh, man, that just turned my world upside down. It was probably about 15, 16 years ago now that I came across that and actually engaged with it seriously for the first time, because I was like, you know, there's something I don't understand about this flood story. You know, why does God just kill people with a flood when he could have forgiven them for their sin?
Right, because what he does for Adam and Eve is he does that with animal sacrifice, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, all this grace extended to people. I mean, there was even grace extended to Cain.
Yeah, because God didn't wipe him from existence.
Yeah. Yeah, so what's going on with the flood? And I think this introduction to Genesis 6, the introduction of the Nephilim, which, by the way, is correctly translated as giants. I know a lot of people will say fallen ones and whatnot. That's because they're assuming it's a Hebrew word. Newsflash for a lot of people reading their Bibles. Yes, it's a Hebrew text, but the Hebrew vocabulary is really small. It's like 6,000-7,000 words. They don't have a word for everything, and they frequently will take words from other languages and use them, and that's just common practice. We do it all the time in English, so I don't know why we're surprised when we find it in the Bible. But the word Nephilim comes from Nephil, which is Aramaic. It does mean giant. You can find that in the Book of Giants, which is a much later work. But anyway, the language is there, right? And all the textual evidence points to the fact that we're talking about large people here. So this is a very unusual situation. And, of course, there are all sorts of parallels in the ancient world. You know, you only have to look at the Greek mythologies, you know, the Trojan War and all that sort of thing. You have Mesopotamian parallels as well. I mean, this part of the Bible is so fascinating because we're right at the early stages where a common core of truth is held by all mankind, and there's just these little variations where they haven't quite stuck to the story, but you can piece it together. You know, and that's what makes this just so fascinating. You know, so the giants come on the scene as a result of the mixture of these the sons of God, these divine beings, and ordinary mortal men. And next thing you know, they are dominating the known world. And they sort of set up a situation where violence is the default response to the slightest provocation. So the situation with the flood, it's necessary because this violence has to be brought to an end. And these non-human entities that God did not create need to be removed. And the situation has got so desperate that Noah and his family are on their own. So this isn't the angry God of vengeance punishing everyone in the world except for Goody Two Shoes Noah.
Right.
This is God extending grace, and the word grace is used explicitly toward Noah, saving him from a fate worse than death. And as for the rest of the created order that has been completely destroyed by these abominations, you know, they're really inconsequential. So that puts a whole other spin on how we interpret the flood story. And I mentioned earlier this idea that the divine beings in rebellion against God were creating this army, right? As you get into Genesis 6, you start to find more and more military imagery being used.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the kind of terminology that starts to come through in the flood narrative depicts this as a massive cosmic war. So we have two stories going on here. On the surface, you have a man in a boat and a great deluge. And beneath that story, in the subtext, with all this Hebrew terminology sort of doing double duty and bringing us these connotations of warfare, we see the violence of the Nephilim and the sons of God as they turn against one another, and this massive destruction that overthrows the world. And these things are all sort of talked about in one story. And that makes a lot of sense if things like, you know, the windows of heaven and the floodgates of the deep and, you know, all these kind of things. What is that? You know, the fountains of the great deep and that sort of thing. We're talking cosmologically here. We're talking about the underworld and the heavens and these opposing forces of good and evil, right? So those loyal to Yahweh the Most High and those who are out for themselves. And this epic battle takes place. And there's all this symbolic language that comes through in the flood story, and particularly numerology. So you have things like the 150 days that the water prevails over the earth. What does that mean? Water's prevailing on the earth. So as I just mentioned, water is a cosmological term, sort of describes the source of spiritual life and the place where divine beings can be found. That's their abode, right? In the ancient mind, divine beings could live where humans can't, right? We can't live in the water. We can't live in the sky. That's where divine beings live. So the idea of the waters prevailing over the earth is a picture of this cosmic battle and the devastation that they're laying waste on the earth. But that number 150 is interesting because you don't find it anywhere else in the Bible. But there is one parallel to it, and it comes in Revelation chapter 9, which speaks about these beasts that come up out of the abyss, right? So again, we're back with this language of the great deep and the cosmic waters and that kind of thing. And these entities come out, they're a mixture of all sorts of different animals and creatures, right? And I talked before about that breakdown distinction between mankind and humanity, between the divine and the mundane, all this kind of thing, right? So this mixture comes through in that imagery used in Revelation 9. These bastard spirits, if you like, coming out of the abyss to torment men for 5 months. Now, on the Hebrew calendar, that is 150 days. So I believe that there's a direct correlation there. And in support of that, what I've noticed is that John, who wrote Revelation, he's heavily influenced by Ezekiel. You see a lot of shared imagery, similar concepts, the Gog-Magog War, which is Ezekiel 38, 39, which comes up again in Revelation toward the end of Scripture there. And the author of the primeval history is also heavily dependent on Ezekiel. Now, that might sound strange to a lot of people, but it's my view that the primeval history took the form that we have it now during the period, or shortly thereafter, of the exile in Babylon, which was around the period of Ezekiel's ministry and his prophetic school, with the people doing the writing. Right, so you've got this common language and these thematic connections that literally go from one end of your Bible to the other. And they're woven through there by authors working on those same points, trying to get those same messages across, right? So everything from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22 comes together by the hand of people that God is using to communicate these unified messages. So we see these 150 days that the waters prevail on the earth during the Great Flood. And we see, when we go to Revelation, the end of all this, but what's happening in the middle? In Ezekiel, as I mentioned, we have the prophecy of the Gog-Magog War. Right here in Genesis, we are seeing a global war. Right? It exactly matches what Ezekiel is saying. And again, this is going to come up in Revelation, in the day of the Lord, and the Gog-Magog War prophesied there. So these connections are really fascinating. But there's more. Because where does that 150 days come from in the first place? What does that even mean? What does that represent? That's been a real puzzle for a lot of people because it never gets explained in Scripture. Yeah. But it turns out that when you consider the world of the first audience of Scripture, these are farming people. They live on the land. As I mentioned before, subsistence farmers, you know, they live on the land and they have to know everything about living on the land because success and failure is life and death, right? So you have to be intimately acquainted with the ways of the land, the ways of animals and nature around you. So this period of 150 days happens to coincide with a couple of things. Number one, it coincides with the life cycle of a locust. And when you go to the prophecies of Joel, he goes through this imagery of these locusts that come and ravage the land. He uses different terminology for the locusts. And one after another, they come and ravage the land and destroy everything. But the names for these different locusts, they're out of sequence because we're supposed to be looking at different stages in the life cycle of the locust. And why are they out of sequence? Because the names of each one of the different stages actually correspond to the different forms that we find these divine beings in Scripture. So we started with the rebellious sons of God and the Nephilim as their offspring. And after the flood, we have the Rephaim. After the Rephaim are gone, we have the demons. And these represent the different stages that Joel describes as stages in the life cycle of a locust.
Okay.
That's a 150-day period. And the idea is to connect this idea of transformation, right? Changing from one form to another. Now, back to the 150 days again, you go for another picture of what that could mean. We also have the gestation period of goats. Now, a lot of goat herders and farmers, of course, in the ancient Near East. So everybody knows that from the time that the female goat conceives, you've got 150 days or 5 months, and the goat is going to give birth to the next generation. So again, you've got this idea of another generation coming up, a transfer from the old generation to the next one, and it's represented in these 5 months. Now, getting on to goats, of course, that makes us think of Leviticus 16 and the Azazel ritual, right? The Day of Atonement. So we have this idea that two goats are selected, one is killed, and the other is released, and it takes with it all the sins of the people. Now, you come back to this situation in the Great Flood, and on either side of this 150 day period, you have the old gods of the ancient world, and the next generation that comes along is going to come through Nimrod after the flood. So the imagery that we get in this idea of 150 days is that the cosmic forces of evil suffer a defeat and a judgment at the hands of God in this flood, in this great cosmic war. But we're not out of the woods yet. And as we progress beyond the flood, we're going to see those powers come back in a different form. And that's what the imagery of the goat and the locust are all about. It's this change, this next generation coming up in a different form to what has been seen before, and that presents a new challenge for the people of God.
Wonderful, TJ. Thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything that you would like to, you know, take 5 minutes or whatever you'd like to just tell people where they can hear more of you or find information about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, sure. Well, just about everything I do, you can trace back to my website, giantanswers.com. And there you can find the link to my podcast, which is the Answers to Giant Questions podcast. That's a production of the Raven Creek Social Club. RavenCreekSC.com is where the podcast lives, but you can link to it from the website. You can also find it on any podcast platform that you might be using, although I probably wouldn't recommend Spotify because they want to charge me for it and then charge you for it, which I don't agree with. So you can use everybody else and still get
it.
Then, of course, the book that started all this, Answers to Giant Questions, that is available on Amazon. Again, you can link to it through the website, giantanswers.com, or you can just go to Amazon, look it up. It's there. It's a really substantial book and hours of reading and research, and it covers a lot more than just what we've been talking about here. Answers to Giant Questions is comprised of six main sections as a bit of a, I guess, kind of systematic theology. I didn't start it out that way, but that's kind of how it went.
Yeah.
And some 40 chapters where I go through the story of the biblical giants from beginning to end. So if that interests you, you really can't go without it. And yeah, it's great value for money for the amount of work and research that went into it. I spent about 13 years putting that book together. And there's a fairly decent bibliography at the back too, so you can check my sources. And yeah, it's a really good read. So yeah, check that out. Subscribe to the podcast. Of course, keep listening to this one because you need both, I reckon. But that's what's going on. I'm probably going to bring out another book eventually, but I will have to leave that until I'm finished doing the podcast. So that's a bit of what's coming in the future, I suppose.
Yeah. Great.
So, that's about all. Just wanted to say thanks, BT, for having me on. And I really enjoyed this opportunity to have this discussion.
Thank you. I appreciate you accepting the invite and look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Have a good night, sir.
All right, you too. See ya.
Thank you for listening. This is a free podcast based upon the value for value model. If you find value in this or any episode, you can return that value by liking the show, subscribing to this channel, leaving a review, or sharing with a friend on your social media accounts. You can also donate on my website. Thank you again. This is BT for Truth and Shadow Podcast. You are the light in the darkness.